Hi, this is Fabi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like
todas las mañanas entra por mi ventana el señor sol.
Hello, hello, hello.
Good show, good show, good show.
Spring has sprung, honey. Mm-hmm.
Even though va a nevar aquí, pero hey, what are you going to do?
Que neva. Hey.
Uh-huh.
Are you on spring break? What's going on? What are you doing? What are the cool kids doing today?
I'm in spring break. I got my first doses. Shout out to...
Two doses? No, two first doses?
La primera...
You're like, bitch, give me Pfizer, Moderna, y chinga su madre, Johnson & Johnson de una vez.
Y dos para llevar, por favor, gracias.
No, sí, salsa verde y roja, sí, gracias.
Christmas.
Christmas, como dicen en Nuevo México, Christmas, pues.
I just want to give a huge shout out to Daisy Quesada and her roommate. They, after the first dose, we got a little sick, and she made us fa, like 3 nights in a row, basically, homemade pho. They cooked that shit for 24 hours. That was it. That's what got us better. So yes, I'm on spring break. I'm getting ready to go see family in Juarez after more than 2 years that I haven't been there since I was there with you, actually. So it's been a while, but everything is good. How are you?
I'm good. I am going to get my second dose today, actually, right after we stop this recording. So I'm excited about that. And then I will be back on my bullshit because you know that
you're already booking flights.
Girl, they're like, oh, you're vaccinated? Great. Can you fly out? I'm like, just give me a couple months, please. So I'm actually excited to announce that I will be doing a solo exhibition at the Des Moines Art Center in Iowa. So all my Latinos in Iowa, I know you're out there.
Salga de donde estén escondidos.
So I'll be there for a whole month. I'll be there late June through July 17th. And so I'm preparing for that exhibition right now among other projects that I have. So it's picked up again, you know. Everything that was postponed because of the pandemic, a lot of the projects that I had anyway, they've been able to reschedule them for this year. So it's going to be a really busy next couple years. So instead of feeling anxious and stressed out and, you know, just paralyzed by my anxiety, I am trying to balance my life and think positively. And I just have to remember every day, like, I'm a full-time artist. People would kill to have the opportunity to be a full-time artist and not have a 9-to-5. Maybe that wasn't the right metaphor right now. They would do anything to be an artist. So I just have to keep that into perspective every time I'm like emailing back and forth and back and forth with the museum person, like, oh my God, what the fuck? But so lots of things
so
on
thankful.
The horizon. Girl, I'm just like, you know what? My goal now is I just want to be an artist, you know, like, you know, we're in the sunset of Latinos Who Lunch, and this podcast has taken up a majority of my time over the last 5 years, you know, and I love it. And I saw it as an extension of my art, but now I'm looking forward to the freedom of being in a place where I don't have to be an administrator or an editor or a producer. I can just make art.
I just
want to have that privilege that a lot of white artists have of just like, I'm going to read a book today and think about it and then write it things down and do some sketches and work in my studio. Like, I've never known that life,
know?
So I slowly want to work that way, like work into that. But I know I have a couple years of trying to set boundaries with people and them not listening to me.
Yeah.
So,
how
are you?
I hear you, especially because, like, I feel like the end of this is the beginning of a lot of new things. Like, I'm deep in research on my book, and I haven't picked up my research from my martyrs in like 4 or 5 years, kind of the length of the podcast as well. So it's, and it's also because like writing a dissertation, as Kirsten says, it's traumatic. So I think coming off of that and finally being able to say, oh, I'm ready. And especially, I think it was being in New Mexico, being here in New Mexico that inspired me, the land of enchantment, inspired me to pick up a lot of those ideas that I dropped off after I left New Mexico. So I hear you. I'm excited. But before we continue, ¿qué estáis comiendo, tío?
What have I been? I've been eating a lot of Brussels sprouts, actually.
Madre mía. Ajale.
I know, I'm very rich. And so, it's, you know why? It's because one of my roommates, I don't know why people do this, but I don't think she listens to this, so I can talk shit. They shop at Sam's Club, and it's great when you have a huge family, but it's like four of us that live here, and we all have very different, well, we don't have that, our diets vary, I'll say that.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, when you go to Sam's Club, you have to buy, like, a 12-pound bag of whatever.
Those galones de mayonnaise.
And I'm like, and I look at the produce, and I'm like, y'all really gonna eat this many lemons? Like, why did you buy an industrial? So I'm just like, it stresses me out to see that much food because I hate to waste food. So in my head, when I see people bringing groceries, I'm calculating like that's only good for 3 days. That's only good for 2 weeks. That's only, you know.
Damn. Yep.
And that's something that I need to let go because it's like from growing up, you know, in the struggle that I know that I do that in my head every fucking time. But I've been urging them to buy food that is that will last a longer time, you know, root vegetables, cabbage, things like that, so that we can have them in the fridge for longer or in storage longer, you know, so we don't waste them. Anyway, oh my God, and can I also say?
Say it.
The way that white people open aguacates is wild.
You know, a couple of years ago, I saw this article of all these people being hospitalized because there was a new import that opened up from Mexico to Britain for avocados. So all these people were like fucking cutting themselves left and right porque la bola de pendejos no saben cómo cortar un aguacate.
No lie, I know a person that almost cut their hand open like all the way
in half.
They had to go to the hospital. Same. Yes, and it was like 5 years ago, like the exact timing. This white lady could not handle it. She probably was watching some YouTube video like, oh, look how easy they cut it. And then we went right through, okay?
Sácatelas.
No, but it's like they don't know how to cut it. So then they waste so much of the aguacate because it's like they don't scrape the whole thing out. I'm like, literally, you just cut it in half and scoop it out. It's not that hard. I can't take it. I can't take it. I got to move out. I got to go to the desert and just hide.
It's nice. It's nice.
Can you see how I'm working on my anxiety? Let it go. Let it go. Okay. I just have to do breathing exercises every time I open the fridge. Oh, so we have a bunch of Brussels sprouts because of that. And I've been following this chef on this really young Korean kid. Oh, I don't think he's Korean. I think he's Asian. He just does a lot of Korean recipes. And his name is Chef George, or Jorge. It's spelled like Jorge, but he says it George. Mm-hmm. And he had a recipe for crispy Brussels sprouts. So basically, oh my God, girl, it's bomb. You make like a Korean paste with a shit ton of like minced garlic in it. And then you like fry up the paste in oil, so it's like extra flavorful. Mm-hmm. And then you take the Brussels sprouts, you do a blanch. It's more than a blanch; it's like 10 minutes, you know. And then so they're cooked, and then you smash all of them flat almost onto a baking sheet. You put it in the oven, you know, or an air fryer, and you get them nice and crispy, and then you pour that sauce on top and let it all like bake in. But you don't want to cook it with the sauce because you want the Brussels sprouts to get crunchy. And the key is to make sure you salt the water so that the Brussels sprouts, so it's like accentuates the natural flavor, the delicious flavor of the Brussels sprout. And for the listeners, can you say the word Brussels sprout in Spanish to give me life one more time?
Coles de Bruselas.
That's going to be the name of my fucking memoir. Oh my gosh.
Dos tíos se llaman Colas de
Bruselas. The Ballad of Justin Favela.
Ay, ay, ay. That sounds so good. I remember in Vegas, there was a restaurant that made this like lemony almond crispy Brussels sprouts, and I've been since.
Cleo's.
Yes!
I know exactly the Brussels sprouts you're talking about, bitch. Remember the days where I was a food writer? That was the only perk. I got to eat everywhere. Cleo's, I'll never forget those fucking Brussels sprouts. Rest in peace.
Bendito, bendito. Ay, ay, ay. So good. Well, I don't have much to report on food because I've been lazy this past, you know what? I was so busy, like hallucinating work, sleeping 4 hours a day. I'm staying up at night, man. When I'm so busy and stressed, like, I estoy pendejo, como dice Rita Indiana, comiendo sopa de techo, just like staring at the ceiling. And last Thursday, I finished my last thing around 4 p.m. and I felt this weight off of my shoulders. And I literally I started dancing. Like I felt so freed. And ever since then, I'm off. I missed a really important appointment today. Like I'm out of it. So I haven't even
had. What does
had
it the, feel like?
Pues raro, güey. Like I don't even have the brain to cook. Like I just want to watch Korean videos of people making cakes. There's like this videos where they do like factory cakes, so they do like 100 cakes at a time and the videos are like 40 minutes long.
Oh bitch, I know exactly. Girl, the videos you're watching. You know I have seen every single one of them. Oh my god, I am obsessed. I was obsessed with those,
like,
videos.
Like un porrito and like you just smoke, open a beer and then watch hours of that shit. And you know what's coming after the flour? Yes, it's the butter. And you know what's coming after the butter, right? And you know exactly what's going to happen. But, ay, Dios mío, it melts brain. It's so good.
You want to really get lost on YouTube?
Sí, por favor.
Okay, search Asian aquarium fish markets.
No!
It's incredible.
Oh, my God. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do.
It's like stores and stores, you know, like it kind of reminds me of like places in Mexico where everything is one thing on a whole block, you know.
Yes.
And it's like a huge building just full of exotic fish. It's fucked up, but it's also visually it looks like
stunning.
Mario Kart, like Rainbow Road, because they like light up all the fish tanks. It's incredible. Speaking of Mario Kart, bitch, did I talk about this?
Uh-uh.
I bought a Switch.
Oh, yeah,
did
you
I tell
did,
you?
Did, but you did.
Oh, okay. Then
so you're playing Mario Kart?
Bitch, you know I have 3 stars and gold trophies in every Grand Prix, 50, 100, 150, and I'm working on mirror mode right now.
Válgame, so dude, I have no idea
I'm
what
gonna,
all those words mean, but like,
I'm
going to
beat this fucking game. With Peach, if it fucking kills me, every Sunday, my one day off, I sit down and I try to beat it. It's been great. It's been a great release. And you know what? I'm just going to tell you guys everything right now because I'm feeling like in a very confessional mood. I also want to let you know that I don't know if this means that I'm really succeeding in life or that I've given up on life. Do you know when you make a purchase like that?
Uh-huh.
Maybe your cappuccino machine.
I was just going to say that.
I bought a pair of Crocs.
No.
Yes, honey. And I'm wearing them right now.
Ay, la María Batala.
But I don't even start to compare me with that fucking pig, okay? And so he's one. I'm like, he's one of the bad ones, right? I'm like, yes, he's a male. Okay. So
white male.
White male. So What was I talking? Oh, Crocs. Oh yeah, I was. So I reached out to a few of my friends, and I was like, "Hey guys, I think I really want to make this purchase." And about three or four of them just texted me back pictures of them wearing Crocs. They're like, "Girl, we all wear them in the house. Like, don't be ashamed."
You're
I'm like,
so
"Okay,
late
I'm buying
to the
them."
Game.
Hashtag not sponsored, but hey, Crocs, reach out. Maybe we can schedule something 2022, 2023.
Oh, my
God. Anyway, I'm sorry. I've completely derailed everything, but you haven't made much food. You're in Albuquerque. You are out of sorts right now because you finished a big project and now you're on to the next thing.
Yes. And I'm scheduling, like, I have all kinds of, like, talks in May. I'm speaking in Yale. Mírala la otra. Ya le hablan de Yale.
Okay, honey.
Right. At the Newberry Library in Chicago. There's a lot of things going on, so it's very, very exciting.
Cool.
But I wanted to move on to our interview today, but I wanted to just publicly say thank you for allowing me this month, basically for indulging me. I've been wanting to do something like this for a while, highlight female voices either in music, and I was able to put together this list of speakers. Shayna, Victoria, of course, Kirsten, which I got so many texts from students and everybody about that interview.
What a beautiful interview. I was like almost in tears every time she would silently, almost silently and swiftly read you with just a pause in her sentences. She is a fucking master.
When I met her... Like, she will
she
do that.
She is so funny.
And
she
will
so funny.
Tilt her head. So mm-hmm. couple mm-hmm. that silence with tilting of the head, and it will dismantle you. And you will just be like, and you will always end up saying the stupidest thing. It took me years for her to do that, and I'll be like, no, don't do that. Don't. I'm not going to do that. Because it's very intimidating. But she's the sweetest.
She's amazing.
So blessed. But today we have a colleague of mine, a dear friend, Dr. Ananda Cohen-Aponte. I wanted to sit down with her. She's been a listener for years now. In fact, one of the reasons why she reached out to me to write this semi-academic paper is because she heard us in the podcast. So she wanted to highlight Babelito more than, you know, Dr. Emmanuel Ortega. So that was very exciting. And that started a friendship. And we're always chatting on WhatsApp. And in this interview, I just wanted to give a quick preview. We talk about a lot mm-hmm. of things, but we talked about a lot of Andean culture. She mentioned things like Tupac Amaru, which was a leader, revolutionary leader of the late 18th century. So when she starts talking about that, that's a little bit of the background. She talks about quipus, and quipus was this system of nuts that the Andean peoples had to record. It was almost like computing, but through nuts. Everything from food, from history. There's so many things that were recorded with these different strings and different nuts, depending on the dye, depending on the amount of nuts. So it's like a very complicated system, and you can Google it. So she talks a little bit about that system of quipus and compares it to here in New Mexico. So there's several things that she introduces, but the main idea is that we talked about Native resistance, because from what I know, besides myself, she's the only one really working on art history and Native resistance. So it was very exciting to be able to sit down with her. So here is our interview with Dr. Ananda Cohen-Aponte.
Babs, you know, it's that time again for me
Dígame.
To talk about our book, The Latinos Who Lunch Coloring Book.
You mean the ABCs of Latinidad, where you can paint everything from anti-blackness to Zacatecas?
Zacatecas, Zacatelas, yes. Oh my gosh, if you don't have this coloring book yet, this is your chance to get it. Go to latinoswholunch.com/coloringbook, click on the link in pink, and go and buy the book.
You don't want to regret it. Get a couple of copies. One
don't
for
don't regret it.
Don't. One for antaño, one for, you know, for authenticity. Just keep it in your drawer, open it, and remember us. And another one para que lo rayes, para que lo cortes, para que hagas lo que quieras.
But oh, don't forget to get your copy. That's a good idea, making a collage. I would love to see that. Somebody. Okay, here, I'll say this. If you make a collage with the coloring book, I'll just send you another one. Orale. You just have to message me. It has to be good, too.
Okay. Wow. The stakes have been rise.
DM me. DM me on Instagram. Okay, latinoswholunch.com/coloringbook.
Hi, audience of Latinos for Lunch. Babelito here, still from Santa Fe, not Albuquerque, but what are you going to do? Today, we have a special interview. This is the last interview of our month of badass women of art history. And today, I have the pleasure and the privilege to have Ananda, or Nandi Cohen Aponte. That's how you pronounce your name, right? Last name? Yeah. The podcast to talk about everything from what do we eat today to Native resistance, and we'll see what happens. So Nandi, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I have been a big Latinos Who Lunch fan for years now. So I'm very heartened and flattered and honored to be part of the last set of talks and interviews that you'll be doing.
I'm so excited. I feel like I met you once. I've seen you twice in the same weekend. But we've always been in communication. And I'm so, so, so excited that you agreed to be in the podcast. So thank you in advance.
Yeah, thank you.
So before we start, this is Latinos Who Lunch. So as always, we always start talking about food. So tell me a little bit about what you maybe had today or some good meal that you had recently.
I knew this question was coming up and I got very nervous because my diet has been really lame as of the last 11 months with a child. So I'm very sad to that today I've had coffee and half cheese, and that's about where I am at today. And I've, you know, being in relative isolation for this past year and being with a baby that was born in almost a year ago, it's my diet has been very all over the place. Generally focused on things that I can eat with one hand and really fast. But I hope you're eating better than I am, because I would love to live vicariously through you.
So I have been in contact with my advisor, Kirsten Pybuick, which you know. And every time we go visit, she introduces to a new world of something food related. And she baked a cake in front of us when we were there. Aww. And she had the whole entire bun cake and she cut it. It was Kentucky Derby, I don't know, something butter, something Southern, something delicious.
Oh,
And she was gonna give us a couple of pieces. But then I think she was feeling guilty as she was noticing how much was left for her. So she ended up reversing the formula and she kept a couple of pieces and left us the whole cake.
Wow.
Which I was so thankful, but also very mad about it. We finished it in a couple of days. It was so good. It was so good. She texted me and said, I feel sorry for giving you all this cake. I'm making a new one.
Oh my gosh, that is love. Actually, that does remind me, along my list of lame foods that I've been eating, one thing that has given me a lot of joy. So I have celiac disease, which means I can't eat gluten, but Oreos just came out with a gluten-free Oreo cookie, and I demolished that entire thing in 2 days. So
shout out to Oreos. You can do all kinds of things with Oreos as well. Yeah, I haven't, it's also been, it's so easy. We're in Zoom, right? So I'm just like, yeah, I'll do that presentation. Yeah, I'll do that. So I found myself doing like 1 to 3 public speaking gigs a week. And I haven't cooked much. Thank God my husband has been doing all of that. So today I had a banana. So it's also not that much more exciting, even though everything is opening here in Santa Fe. So we'll see. Maybe we'll start eating more delicious food and I'll have something more excited to report.
Well, honestly, I feel a little bit better now because we're in the same boat and we're both undernourished for the day. So
yes, definitely. Coffee and banana. That's it. So this is going to be great. Okay, Nandi, tell us a little bit more about yourself, who you are, what you do, where you at, so our listeners can start Googling you.
Oh wow. Okay. So I'm Nandi Conaponte. I am currently an associate professor of art history at Cornell University. I have been here in Ithaca now for 8 years, going on 9. It's crazy how the time flies. Before this, I'll just work my way backwards. I was finishing my PhD at CUNY Graduate Center in New York City. So I lived in New York for 8 years and I moved there right after undergrad and pursued a PhD in art history. And New York is, of course, very near and dear to me. And I can't wait to be fully vaccinated to be able to go back and see old friends, see my in-laws and other loved ones. I was born in Michigan. I was raised in North Carolina. I've always been really into the arts. I'm Cuban American and also Jewish, and something that was a really big deal for me was when I was in high school, I got the opportunity to go to a magnet school for the visual arts called Northwest School of the Arts in Charlotte. Big shout out to Northwest. It really changed the entire trajectory of my life. We pride ourselves, first of all, our mascot is the dragon, and we pride ourselves as being the North Carolina version of LaGuardia, which of course we know is the FAME school. And I got a chance to take visual art classes and studio art, and I also got a chance to take art history. They offered AP classes my senior year, and one of them was AP Art History. And it was taught by our ceramics teacher, Miss Barefoot, and she was amazing. It was the first time she had ever taught it. It was the first time we had ever been exposed to it. And honestly, from that moment, I was totally hooked. I mean, I just loved being able to learn about history through images, being very visually oriented already. It was just like it was like the light turned on for me. And then fast forward to undergrad, I went to the University of Michigan for my undergraduate degree, and I double majored in anthropology and art history. And I took a lot of really phenomenal art history classes, but the one thing that was really lacking was anything related to Latin America. And I actually learned more about Latin American art through anthropology. I wanted to be an archaeologist, and I went on a dig actually in your neck of the woods in Roswell, New Mexico.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then that same summer I did, I was the laboratory manager for a dig in Apizaco in Tlaxcala. And that was a really amazing summer for me, being able to see archaeology in action. Washing a lot of artifacts with toothbrushes and labeling them and putting them into bags. And I thought, okay, I think this is where I want to go with my career. And so I went back to Michigan for my senior year. I was enrolled in the honors thesis class for archaeology. And I somehow got basically lured into a thesis about antelope bones. And because the person who had been leading the project was really into faunal remains. And honestly, I got really into it. I could identify tarsals and metatarsals and the scapula and all of this stuff. Wow. But I like got halfway through the semester of like analyzing antelope bones every Friday for hours. And like this pit of despair started to just like emerge. And I was like, I can't do this.
I can do bones for the rest of my life.
I do antelope bones. And in theory, it was really interesting. Like, for instance, if you take a look at the antelope bones, you can figure out if it was burned or if it was boiled. And that actually had implications for like gendered divisions of labor, because women tended to do more boiling and men tended to do more like hearth type, like fire related cooking. In theory, it was interesting, but I started to really just feel like I can't do this anymore. I dropped out of my thesis project, but I also happened to be taking a history class with Rebecca Scott, who is a world-renowned historian. I feel so lucky to have been able to take her course on colonial Latin America. And it was history, so there were very, very little in the way of images or anything like that. But it just blew my mind. I mean, I was riveted every class. I just couldn't stop thinking about it. It unlocked for me a much more profound understanding of my Cuban identity, which is something that growing up, I only knew through food and through family, but never with the understanding that there's like a whole deep history there. Mm-hmm. And so it was just this profound moment where I felt like a lot of the pieces started to come together. And my big question for myself was like, wait a minute, did these people make art? Because I've never heard about Latin American art. And so it was like, it was really late in the game. I was a senior and I should have known as an art history major, but again, this was never covered in any way, shape or form. So I embarked on like a bunch of self-study and reading on my own to realize like, okay, this is the direction that I want to go.
And I think a lot of, with all due respect, a lot of our colleagues forget that there's this need for first generation, for BIPOC kids to go into art history and to try to find a part of themselves that they haven't been able to find anywhere else. Because as Kirsten was saying the last episode, visual literacy, it's so important and it's so imperative, especially in a society where we're sliding through images like every second or so. We're like engaging with them in a completely different way. And I think that there's a lot of como ramas of academia that people forget they're anchors for kids to learn identity. That happened to me. And the problem is that, similar to you, I was introduced to art history in a very European way. So I was investigating and learning so much about Italy. And it got to a point where I was like, this has nothing to do with who I am at all. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I traveled to Mexico that I found myself in a place where I knew nothing about. We were at Matotonilco in Guanajuato, covered, mm-hmm. you know, this church covered in frescoes. I was like, I know about the Sistine Chapel, and this is the Sistine Chapel of Mexico, you know, because they're always mm-hmm. aligning with Europe. Mm-hmm. And I was mad. I was angry in my education. I was angry in my background. And that was the moment where I said, that's it. Like, I don't want to learn more European stuff. It's time to learn something about Mexico. Because I also had AP art history. But mm-hmm. we did a replica of the girasoles of Van Gogh on the window. I knew everything about Van Gogh because my teacher was obsessed with that. But that's it.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I took AP art history and I loved that everything made sense. Like everything fit this perfect narrative. It all kind of came together, but it was at the expense of the entire rest of the world. And I'll never forget, like the final essay for the AP art history exam was like, do something about like, do a comparative analysis of a Western and a non-Western work of art.
Oh my God.
They threw the non-Western curveball, even though we had literally learned nothing at all outside of Europe. And I swear to God, I was scratching my head for 10 minutes, like, wait, where is Western and where is un-Western. And I don't understand, like, I was taking them seriously as like geographical anchoring points. And of course, now we of course know what Western and non-Western means and the problematic histories behind those ideas. But I remember I was like digging deep and I was like, okay, non-Western. I think I finally figured out that meant non-European or AKA the rest of the world. And I thought back to my art history textbook, which had this enormous picture of King Tut on the front. I was like, aha, Egypt is non-Western. And we did learn about Egypt, of course, be for obvious reasons of it being aligned with the Western world. And so I wrote like this lame essay about comparing King Tut with I don't know who, Van Gogh or something. And it was kind of like, that was one of the first cracks in the veneer where I was like, something's being actively left out here and I'm not understanding it. And then it starts to kind of like, it starts to all come together later on.
To me, the first crack was my undergrad advisor, Dr. Kelly, Kathy Kelly, rest in peace. She was teaching Renaissance architecture. And I don't remember what building it was. She said, oh, this resembles a little bit of what happens in certain churches in Mexico, where indigenous people will place the symbols on the facade as a form of resistance. She said it like that. And I was like, what is this? Like, you white lady talking about my country, about something I don't know anything about, and I went on a quest. And it wasn't until like much later, when I took my first graduate courses, that I learned about some of the mission churches of the 16th century in Mexico, that I was like, I think this is what Kathy Kelly said. This is what she was referring to. But once again, I was angry that I didn't know this material. And I'm still angry that I will talk to so many family members and I will tell them about this. I will tell them, you know, like, if you think about this church, you see the rest of the world, like, there's so many things happening right here and have no idea. And it has nothing to do with their level of education. It's just that, you know, we haven't been exposed to that. So I wanted to ask you something in relation to that, in terms of advising, because I know you've gotten awards of advising in Cornell. So how much of that affects not only your teaching, but your advising, especially when you come into the classroom, when you have somebody that may want to do yet another paper of the Virgen de Guadalupe? Like, how do you walk a student around some of these ideas of not only understanding the colonial period, but also do you push them to bring a little bit about their identity on it, or you let them find their own journey?
I have so much to say about that. I mean, one thing speaking about being angry, I mean, one thing that's really upsetting to me is that as an old person, I finished high school in the year 2000, right?
Me too.
Yay. And we were the smoke-free class of 2000. Did you guys get those shirts in the Oh, well, wait, but you went to school in Mexico, right?
No, I graduated in Nevada, but I got fully funded for my undergrad because they sued some tobacco company. And that's how I got my money to go to undergrad, even though...
Oh my God, that's interesting. So, well, related to that, I remember in kindergarten, we got our smoke-free class of 2000, the idea that we would all not be smoking by then. Obviously, that didn't happen. But that's beside the point. I graduated high school in the year 2000, right? Our current undergrads are graduating high school almost 20 years later, and hardly anything has changed. I'm teaching a class right now where I would say the probably 90% of my students are Latinx, which is extremely amazing, especially at a place like Cornell. That was usually, you know, when I taught as an adjunct in the CUNY system, it was also majority POC classroom, but that really hadn't happened until I've been at Cornell now for many years. And I know that a lot of Latinx students and other students of color flock to classes like mine because they're interested in learning about themselves. And I, at the beginning of every semester, I always ask, you know, what is you're interested in this class. And I say, it's okay if it's a requirement, no hard feelings, I totally get it. And I would say that the vast majority of students said either a combination of one, I'm Hispanic, some say Hispanic, or I'm of Latin American descent and I want to learn about myself. Or number two, I want to learn about art outside of the European framework. And so that's telling me that even as students are totally saturated in this new digital world of like increased access to images, access to knowledge is still extremely limited. So I almost feel like we're still dealing with the same issue that we dealt with as high schoolers, that people generations before us also dealt with. And so that is disheartening. What is heartening to me is that I have the opportunity to change trajectories and to allow students to dream big and to think about how art history might be in their future in whatever way, shape, or form that can take. One thing that I'll never forget that was incredibly moving for me is that for one of my current book project is looking at art and insurgency in the late colonial Andes and looking at the relationship between art and an anti-colonial consciousness. But at the same time, I'm also looking at images of repression that were being produced en masse in the aftermath of these rebellions that were upholding the agendas of like the Bourbon reformers and of a society of absolutism. And so as part and parcel of that project, I'm looking at a series of maps. And one of them is this map of the intendancy of Tarma in Peru, in the central Andes. And I was teaching my intro to Latin American art class, and I had a student who came to office hours. And he was like, oh, I'm from Peru. I was like, oh, where are you from? And he's like, I'm from Tarma. I was like, oh my God, will you look at this map? And he was looking at this colonial map and he was like, oh, you know, my father's a taxi cab driver in this community. And he's like, and he was pointing to all these places on this map and being like, oh yeah, that's accurate. Like, oh yeah, I've been here, I've been there. And I was like, oh my gosh, I should print an image of this so you can bring it back. This was years ago before COVID. And I think he was going to Peru over spring break. And I was like, you know, you should show this to your family. And it really opened my eyes to the importance of not only engaging with Latin American international students, but also Latinx students who are first gen or who are recent immigrants to this country as really profound sources of knowledge and the importance of creating pathways for Latinx students and other students of color to be able to do on-the-ground research in their home countries, because that is something that I don't think is emphasized enough. And it was a profound moment for me to think, you know, that this could be the start of like a really meaningful research collaboration and the importance of really privileging it, the expertise of undergrads and breaking down those research barriers to ones that are more horizontal rather than vertical and hierarchical.
It's amazing. I have had so many students similar that they said, oh, I'm going to spend Semana Santa in San Luis Potosí. I'm like, that's your paper. Really? I can write about that? Like something that has been in my family so long? I say, yes. Like what you're describing right now, that's your paper. Tell me a little bit more about that. Take some pictures with your phone. And they get so excited because they have never offered the opportunity to think about their own daily life sometimes when they lived in Mexico or other parts in that regard. But I wanted to ask you, and this is a little bit different. You started talking about anthropology. You talk about Central Mexico, and now you research South America. Now you research Peru. What was your trajectory that led you to study South America?
Yeah, well, I was really interested in the Southwest and in and in Mexico. And actually going to New Mexico that summer, that I was like, oh my gosh, New Mexico is like another planet. It's amazing out here. It was just, it was a profound moment in my own development. I took a train from the Midwest all the way out to Albuquerque, and just seeing the country in that way that I had never seen it before was something that was very moving for me. But I went to graduate school with the intention of studying Aztec manuscripts. And as such, I chose to work with Eloise Quiñones Keeper, who was my advisor. And first she was like, why don't you study Cuban art of the colonial period? Because, you know, you're Cuban American, so you should really consider that. And I just didn't feel like, in terms of the complications of my family's history and relationship with the island, coupled with the fact that colonial Cuban art was completely unknown to me, because I think that colonial Caribbean and colonial Central American art tends to be double marginalized within art history. So I thought, I don't know about that, but let me think about other places. And I applied for an internship through the US Embassy in Peru. And I got an internship at the Museo Tumbas Reales de Señor de Zipán in Lambayeque. And with, you know, like the museum associated with that massive archaeological site. And that changed everything. That was in 2007. And I was there for 2 months. It changed my life. And I thought, okay, I want to continue my work here. And so I ended up pursuing a dissertation topic that was in Cusco, but my first exposure to Peru and my first intellectual community that I met was in the North Coast. And those are people who still are very near and dear to me today.
So tell us a little bit more about your research. You are a colonial art historian. You work with Peru. What are some of the aspects that inform informed your first book, but also are informing some of the things that you're working with today?
Yeah, so my first book was based on my dissertation, Heaven, Hell, and Everything in Between, Murals of the Colonial Andes. And I have to give a shout out to my friend Pilar Rao, who came up with the title, because I just could not figure it out. And we were on this 8-hour bus ride in the Andes, and we just kept saying words, like throwing out words. And then she finally said it. I was like, oh my God, I have to write this down. This is the title. But that was based on my doctoral dissertation, which in turn was inspired actually by the mural paintings of East Harlem. So there's already like a Latinx to Latin America trajectory that I really want to emphasize here, because when I was in graduate school, I was a volunteer curator at Art for Change, which was an organization that was run out of a really amazing place called Carlitos Cafe in East Harlem that was overseen by Eliana Godoy, who now is doing amazing stuff in the realm of education. And we were curating shows about Latinx art and local artists. And every time we would go to the place, I would pass by the murals that are all over the neighborhood, but especially concentrated within like between 100th Street and 110th Street on the east side. And I just was so blown away by murals of Celia Cruz and Pedro Pietri and Big Pun and all of these other, there was another one that was like a mural showing the history of the community. And I remember just thinking like, this is something I would love to work on or study or do some kind of map about this, because it's really amazing how you have this urban space, but these murals are really creating a sense of community and a sense of place and space and all of that. And so it was with that in mind that I became really interested in mural painting as an aesthetic that's very much rooted in place. And I was really interested in murals of the colonial period because I wanted to see how indigenous and mestizo artists of the Andes were using Christian iconography and source images in concert with many other sources as well, textiles, material culture, canvas paintings, and all of that. as a way of really articulating a local vision of their community and using using source imagery in these very strategic ways that could either be a way of asserting agency or even a way of subverting colonial authority. And so I had a whole series of case studies, and it was something that was a really amazing experience, especially because being in the space of the church, being within these multimedia space of looking at these murals in architecture, it was a one-of-a-kind experience that you can really only get from being there yourself. And so
I just wanted to say that one of the things about colonial Latin American art and art history is that in the popular imaginary, muralism tends to be concentrated in the pre-Columbian period or in the modern period. But that's one of the things that I learned early in my grad education, that's something that continues throughout the colonial period. There's like a long and rich history of colonial murals that we know nothing about.
Yeah, definitely. And as a matter of fact, I did one of my book chapters is about the Sistine Chapel in the Andes. So compete with the Mexican. Everywhere is a Sistine Chapel of something.
Always yes.
Yeah, but I became really fascinated with, so I think the last chapter of the book really set the stage for my new project. And the last chapter was focused on these murals at the Church of Huaro, which is located not too far from Cusco, maybe half an hour away, in the southeastern province of Quispicanchi. And I was blown away by these murals, which were completed in 1802. By a rare twist of fate, the artist signed the murals, which is very unusual. And his name was Tadeo Escalante. And he was known to be one of the last famous painters of the Cusco School of Art. And he was basically straddling two worlds, because he was born, we think, around 1770s. Died around the 1830s or 40s. So he was straddling not only the colonial and the post-colonial, or the colonial and the Republican, but he was also straddling the Tupac Amaru era, pre and post. And we know that based on archival evidence that he may have been related to this illustrious indigenous elite family in this town of Acomayo that was allied with the Tupac Amaru rebellion. Long story short, the whole thing about these murals is that they were produced in 1802, about 22 years after the outbreak of this major anti-colonial rebellion. And the murals themselves are incredibly apocalyptic. They're dealing with issues of good and evil, of hell, the last judgment. There's all these allegories about like the wealthy as being full of sin and greed and lust and avarice. And I was thinking to myself, you know, why these extremely like medieval topics for something that was ostensibly an early 19th century mural? Escalante could have used any number of source imagery or ideas for this. Why these images? And of course, building on the advances that have already been made by many other scholars in Peru and Bolivia, I really started to piece together, you know, how we can think about this through the lens of this anti-colonial rebellion. So this has become the starting off point for my new project, which is looking at, like I mentioned before, art and anti-colonial resistance in the Andes.
So in one of your articles, I remember reading a question that you posted that has stuck with me ever since I read it, because I've been trying to do something similar, but the way you phrased it was beautiful. You said, it begs the question, how do we tell a story about rebellion through objects? You talk about the importance of looking at visual and material culture in order to understand some of these big rebellions. And just to like set it up a little bit, one of the things that we tend to forget about the colonial period is that it wasn't just encounters and then everybody was holding hands. Maybe the Inquisition was a little messy. And then you had a couple of virgins appear here and there, a couple of Creole intellects, and then independence. Because that's how I learned the colonial period, right? Like studying all the way to La Secundaria in Mexico. Mm-hmm. But there's thousands, hundreds, if not thousands of encounters that never stops. We also have that resistance continues. When we think about Mexico, for instance, the area of where the Chichimecas are, like the northern area or like the more nomad tribes in states today, it's Guanajuato, Zacatecas, all of that part of Mexico wasn't truly mm-hmm. all fully conquered, quote unquote. When I think about resistance, I'm here in New Mexico. They were independent for more than a decade in the 1680s. And then I think of Chile, the Mapuches were never fully conquered either. They were always in negotiation with the Spanish. So to mm-hmm. think about the colonial period as like this beautiful colonial period, which is how you learn the art sometimes. Because we're talking about how we don't even get to learn anything from that period or anything Latin American in the U.S. education system. But then when you get to learn it, it's this glorified period, right? And you are talking about something that is very important. I don't know many scholars that are thinking about rebellion. They're thinking about revolution. They're thinking about insurgency in relationship with objects. So again, how do we learn more about revolution through objects in the colonial period?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right, because as I was putting together my ideas for this research and trying to do as much comparative and background reading as possible, I kept asking myself, you know, where are the art history books or articles about the Haitian Revolution? Where are the art historical analyses of Tupac Amaru? Where are the art historical analyses of Juan Santos Atahualpa Rebellion? I mean, there are so many, or the Pueblo Revolt, right, which is better understood at least through the lens of historical archaeology. But I just kept feeling like there's a huge visual component that's missing. And I've really been lucky to have been able to engage with so much rich historical work that's been done on Tupac Amaru Rebellion in particular, by Peruvian and US and European historians. But again, there's this tremendous void when we're talking about imagery. And of course, the thing about Tupac Amaru is that he has been famously described as the hero without a face by the late historian Pablo Macera, because we don't have any large scale portraits that survive of him. And I think that with a couple of exceptions, a lot of scholars have sort of taken that as just, well, they don't exist anymore. If we don't have the portrait, then we don't really have anything to work with. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do is two things. Number one is to basically argue that it's not so much, that actually the absence of the portrait, that visual void, has created in the modern and contemporary period this fluorescence of creativity, because there have been so many successive generations that have sought to reimagine him, precisely because we don't have a historical image of what he looked like. Yeah. So that's really amazing. There's conceptual art, there's installation art representing Tupac Amaru, there is performance art that's been, you know, of the 21st century. In the 1960s, there was also a revival of the history of the Tupac Amaru Rebellion. So we have a lot of portraits and prints from the 1960s that have sought to try to reimagine him. So that also gets me to another point, which is, what do we do with this visual void? If the portraits have been lost or destroyed, what other things might have been lost or destroyed that we don't know about? And so that took me on this huge journey into the documentation of the rebellion through court proceedings that occurred, because I think it was the historian David Cahill that said, like, the Tupac Amaru Rebellion is one of the most well-documented moments in colonial Latin American history because of the profound threat that it exerted on the future of Spanish colonial rule. There were all of these court proceedings that occurred in this aftermath to try to snuff out any and all potential rebels that needed to either be put to death or other types of terrible sentencing. And so I was looking through these documents, which have always been looked at from a historical lens, for anything related to images. Right. And as a matter of fact, I found so much, many references. References to history paintings. Like, there was a whole series of history paintings called La Historia Diabolica about the history of the rebellion with actual descriptions of every painting that no longer exist. Or if they do, we don't know where they are. I found like 25 references to portraits, references to wooden medallions that bore his face and that of his co-conspirator and wife, Micaela Bastidas, references to statues of the Virgin Mary that were skewered with tupus, or statues that were beheaded. There were so many object-oriented stories within the rebellion that have just not been brought to light. So a lot of my work is about archival recovery and trying to flesh out images that only exist as archival description. Another piece of that is to look to paintings and other works of art that have been deliberately defaced or repainted. And what's really amazing about this is that our eyes are trained to see things in a certain way. And so I can't tell you how many times I would look at a painting and just take it at face value. And then years later, because of this new research focus, I look carefully. There's all of these layers of paint, people being covered up, faces that have been scratched. But because of the particular like art historical eye that we've been trained with, oftentimes you just take it as face value that, oh, well, colonial paintings are always a little weird, so maybe that's some blemish, but we don't really pay attention to that. Let's just look at the central image.
That's fascinating, because I think it's thinking about the void when it comes, or like what, speaking of the Haitian Revolution, Trilot says, the silences of history, thinking about in those voids, that's where you get a lot of this information. And it's so fascinating to me to hear about this. It was a revolution in South America, in Peru. And when you tell me about the administrative repercussions of that, that's exactly what happened here. There's so many things, presidios starting to be created. I'm reading right now Carlos Sigüenza y Góngora's takes on the revolution here in 1680 and how that changes everything. And I think it was a profound shooketh moment for the Spanish, because I think they thought they had everything under control, just like they thought they did by the 1600s. So it's two different administrations, but same sort of like the same state of mind, that they think everybody's been converted, they think everything is great, and then you have these movements, because otherwise you have little rebellions in the eyes of the empire, little rebellions here and there, never really a fully fleshed out revolution. So when that happened, they have to reckon with their administration, and that's something that thinking about art history starting from that, and then sort of like the manifestations of that visual and material, that's something that we're missing and we need to do more work on. It's fascinating work.
Yeah, and I was really inspired actually by the work that's been done about the Pueblo Revolt, which I'm sure you know a lot more about than I do, but it's really striking to me that this happened it was 1680, right? Mm-hmm. So it's exactly 100 years before Tupac Amaru. But one of the key stories around the Pueblo Revolt is that there was the knotted cord, and that the cord was passing through different community members, and that they would each undo a knot. And then once the knot was fully undone, that was the day that they were going to revolt. Or correct me if I'm wrong, but something along those lines. And I just couldn't stop thinking about that knotted cord. I was like, this is very Franciscan, but it's also very Kipu-esque. And, you know, I was also thinking about what are the networks of friars and other ecclesiastical personnel who are constantly crisscrossing the viceroyalties and bringing stories with them. And is and could it be also that there was a Kipu in the Southwest that had been brought over? Because we know that Kipus in the 17th century Andes were used, were reappropriated as mnemonic devices for confession. And so there were there was a huge interest amongst the Franciscans and I think the Jesuits in using the quipus for religious purposes. So I'm also interested in those kinds of material connections too.
Esos religiosos hicieron desorden. Like they would appropriate everything. It's a mess. This is fascinating, Nandi. And I feel like we're just starting to scratch the surface on some of these ideas. But I want to give you some time to maybe promote anything you're working with. Are there any articles? I wanted to spend more time talking about diversity and inclusion in art history, but I really want to give you some time to maybe tell us about where we can find you, anything you're promoting, anything. Dale.
Okay, let's see. I have a website, anandaconaponte.com, where you can find copies of all the articles that I've written, as well as links to my books that I've published. I'm currently working on a number of different essays that are at various stages of the pipeline, but perhaps the one that's going to be coming out the soonest is an essay that I'm writing for the online journal Selva, S-E-L-V-A, and that one is going to be looking at images. I forgot the name of the title of the essay, but something about images of Black and Indigenous resistance in the Atlantic world. And so this is kind of opening the aperture a little bit to look comparatively across from the Andes to the Caribbean, to bring together a suite of objects, both historical and contemporary, as a way of a provocation for thinking a little bit more creatively about how we do art history and thinking through the lens of surrogacy. So if we're talking about all of these absences and all of the archival or visual voids that happen because of colonial repression, can we look to other places and other times as to find objects as stand-ins for the what could have been? And so it's also somewhat speculative and it's a very experimental essay that I'm really excited about. And so that's going to be published hopefully within the next couple of months. And of course the book project, we can hope that that will be within the next few years, but you know, with COVID preventing travel and an almost one-year-old, things have been slowing down a little bit, so I've had to put some projects on hold. And then I'm also looking into funding opportunities to expand an initiative that I've started at Cornell on pathways to art history, which I'm right now in the process of integrating in all of my classes. So for instance, for my Latin American survey this semester, their final project, instead of it being an exam or a paper, is actually going to be to produce pedagogical materials for teachers in middle and high schools who are all networked through this anti-racist art history group that I'm a part of. And so to really think critically about, you know, asking themselves, what do I wish I had known before college? Like what would have been meaningful for me back then and helped to build my knowledge earlier than I, you know, than now. So that's also a long-term project that I've been working on that I hope to get big money to be able to expand it nationally and internationally.
So I just wanted to plug this really quick. One of the reasons why we started talking, Nandi and I, is because she invited me to be part of this volume for the Latin American and Latinx visual culture. The title of the volume of the essays was Addressing Diversity and Inclusion in Latin American Art and Latinx Art History. And you invited a series of Latinx art historians working on their area. Because one of the things that I forget is I'm one of the few Mexicans in the United States working with Mexican colonial art history and our paths to get there. It was the first and the only opportunity I've had to talk about or rendir tributo a mi familia, to really talk about the ethics I inherit from my family and the ways that his approach to labor is similar to mine, but in different ways, not academic at all. And I think you can purchase it, or maybe I'll set up a link in the website to some of those essays. But the group of the essays of that volume is beautiful because it really allows you to think about some of these ideas that we'll be talking about in terms of what Latinx art historians or art history kids are thinking about and what they're looking for in art history. And these are success stories, but it's not necessarily always that way. And for that, I want to say thank you, because it was such a, writing that essay, when I finished, I was like, oh my God, if every essay I wrote was like this, it was just such a breeze and it was so beautiful.
Yeah, it was a really powerful and cathartic experience. I worked on it with a dear friend and colleague of mine, Elena Fitzpatrick Sifford, and we know each other from way back because we went to graduate school together. And you know, we had been having ongoing conversations, and then we thought, you know, maybe we need to turn this into something bigger than just a conversation between the two of us. And it was very scary because You don't want to upset. I mean, we're working in a small field and you don't want to ruffle feathers or mess with the status quo, so to speak. But we have been very heartened by the outpouring of support that we got as a result of publishing these essays and publishing the statistics that we had gathered about in racial inequities within the field. And the one thing that has been the most meaningful to me is that I've gotten a lot of feedback from colleagues who have been able to use this set of essays as a reason, or like to bring it to the administration for evidence of why strategic hires need to be made, why we need to diversify our graduate student cohorts, why we need to be recruiting BIPOC students into this field. So I'm really happy that not only was it an important exercise in just exploring these personal narratives around art history, but it also has been used for pushing institutional change.
This is amazing, amazing work. Everything you do is incredible. We read you in class. And I'm very, very thankful to have you as a colleague. And you've always been very supportive of everything that I do. And for that, I want to publicly thank you very, 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 very much.
Well, thank you for an amazing podcast, as well as an amazing YouTube channel, and for all the things that you're doing. Because I know that based on all of the conversations that you've had over the years on the podcast, that you have changed futures and opened up a space for youth to dream big. And I'm super excited to continue to get those very students into my classroom who you've inspired through your advocacy. So double thank you.
Where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter, Dr. Nandi Ko.
Yes, you are. Very active. That's one of the few things I miss about Twitter, seeing all of your posts.
Oh, you got to come back to the dark side. But yes, I'm on Twitter. I have my website that I mentioned before. And that's about it for now. But yes, please feel free to reach out, engage. My email is very easily findable online. I hope to be in touch with many of you out there.
And I'll put the links to your Twitter, to your website, and to your profile in Cornell in latinoswholunch.com. Nandi, un placer. Muchísimas gracias. I know you're super busy and you're carrying a lot of this load when it comes to putting together a family, but it's also changing a discipline. And that's just huge. And thank you so much.
Igualmente. Thank you for the opportunity.
Nos vemos.
And we're back.
¿Qué tal? ¿Qué opinas?
All right. Well, I mean, I wrote down a quote that pretty much summarizes what you guys talked about. Are you ready?
Uh-huh.
Esos religiosos hicieron desmadre.
In a few words.
That is exactly what you guys talked about. But oh my God, it was so interesting. And I really like her perspective, like almost like as an archaeologist, you know, I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show you, we don't fucking know anything. You know, like once you learn one little thing, you're just like, it just opens up a whole new world a whole new history that has never been told, you know?
And the thing is that we have, like, for example, I spent 10 years learning patterns of colonization, but in New Spain, which, you know, the southwest of the states, in Mexico, even part of Central America. And it wasn't until I went to Chicago that I started to learn a little bit more about South America. Girl, South America and the colonial period, it's its own monster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been so useful to think about the Andeans and the ways they resisted, they handle the colonial structures, that it's so different from Mexico. And that's how I ran into her scholarship. And it's just amazing stuff. And I feel like all of the different voices highlighted this past month, they're alternatives to your usual art history. Because when I tell people that I do art history, when you talk about art history in general, it's almost like a turnoff because it's such an oppressive discipline. It's so white. I mean, we talked about it with Kirsten. But what scholars like Victoria, Shayna, Nandi, and Kirsten are doing, it's in a way flipping the coin a little bit and giving you two things. One is that you can do a lot of things with the tools of art history that is not the same mm-hmm. bullshit. And second, mm-hmm. you can highlight all kinds of different voices that have been erased throughout history. So shout out to all the four women in this month. I think it's so important to have recorded their voices here in the podcast, but also to show that... I don't know, like, I'm a nerd, but I feel like art history can be cool, man, you know? Like, it's not just about, like, ay, mira los colores, que yes. bonitos, me siento bien acá, guara la fucking cuchara, you know?
And can I just say this? You keep saying, thank you for letting me do these episodes. Bitch, I've been begging you to do these episodes for years, so don't get it twisted.
I just felt like, speaking of colonialism, I feel like I colonized the podcast for this month, but I'm like, I gotta take
Why?
This opportunity.
We want, the people want it. I'm like... you don't know how happy I was to hear all these people on the show, especially Kirsten, you know, because we've been talking about her for years. But like, yeah, of course. And you know what? I'm not even kidding, Babs. I don't know. It's like a perfect timing, or like, I don't know what kind of intervention. I was going to say divine intervention. But I have a show that I proposed like a year ago here in Las Vegas this mm-hmm. year. And it's going to be all about fruit.
Oh.
Inspired by still lifes of fruit, like the history of still life painting, because I wanted to kind of shift gears. I'm so excited to really dive into Shayna's book, The Fruits of the Empire, because I think I'm going to use a lot of what I learn in these exhibitions, or at least highlight some things that I probably would have never looked at. And listening to the interview today, you know, I've been watching Survivor since the pandemic started.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I have to make an artwork. I have to make an artwork about Survivor somewhere, somehow. And I think I've narrowed down my idea, kind of dissecting the symbols that they use and the architecture of the set of Survivor when it's based in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't wait to dive into all this research from all the scholars, really, that you've had on the show to really kind of inform the decision. So you're right. Like, people think that art history is boring, but like, it inspires a lot of artists, first of all. And then those artists point people sometimes in the direction of the academic writings, you know, and it just opens up a whole new world. And also, then that changes like the regular history books as well. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Whatever that means.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
anyway.
I think it's also like a good window into like the possibilities of thinking about, like, as Kirsten said, visual culture is so important right now. Like, we engage with images like nothing. So to think and stop and actually like be critical of like a lot of the images that we take could completely change the way that we see life. So again, thank you, Nandi, so much. This was so, so wonderful. And thank you to all the amazing women of this month. It's being such a pleasure. And again, thank you, Favi. Thank you, thank you.
You're welcome. You have any recommendations?
Yes, I have a quick recommendation for all the EDM heads out there. There's this album. It's more like house music by Sofia.
Presente.
It's this album called Fresia Magdalena. It's an EP, really, by Sofia Cortesis. And it's actually a beautiful, beautiful album. This is a producer from Peru via Germany. But it's very interesting because this is dedicated to Sarita Colonia. And Sarita Colonia was this victim of really like a lot of things in Peru, including poverty. Anyway, she died. And I'm doing a disservice, so you have to Google it, Sarita Colonia. But she died and her body was dumped in this place in Peru. And ever since then, and this was in the 1940s, she's become the saint of criminals, the saint of prostitutes, the saint of homosexuals, the saint of homeless people. There's parties outside of her graveyard in Peru. So this album is a little bit of a reflection of those neighborhoods in Lima. It's a little bit of a reflection of that life, but also it's a reflection of the history of this saint. Again, the album is Sofia, the producer is Sofia Cortesis. The album is Fresia Magdalena. And again, a beautiful tribute to Sarita Colonia. Check it out. So that's my recommendation. What about you?
Well, this week, I think I'm going to go into the YouTube universe and recommend a channel that I found. And you know, for years I've been trying to get my mom to record her recipes with me, but she refuses. She hates the camera. And I'm like, at this point I gave up because I'm, you know, once TikTok showed up, I was like, oh, we could do TikToks and we don't have to show you. We can just like show your hands and we can do the voiceover together. I just wanted her to, you know, encourage her because her food is so fucking good. And I don't think she realizes it, you know?
Right.
It's just so bomb. Anyway, I was just looking through YouTube trying to find good Guatemalan recipes, and I found one, and it is called Cocinando con Alma. And she's so cute, and her and her family are always cooking, and I like that she's very humble. She's not saying, like, this is the way that all Guatemalans make this, but it's always like, this is how my family does it. If you have a problem with it, then go talk to your family. But this is how we do it, you know? And I love that. So I'm really looking forward to making some chuchitos. Do you know what chuchitos are?
No, I sure don't.
Oh, girl. They're so bomb. So Guatemalans, they make tamales with banana leaves, right? But they also do chuchitos, which are almost a version of, like, Mexican tamales, but they're very different. They're a lot more dense, and it's almost like a lot of the times they have like picadillo in it, you know. If you don't know what that is, it's like ground beef with vegetables and spices, you know,
right?
Or whatever protein. It doesn't have to be meat. It could be just vegetables and recado, which is what they call the sauce. And so it's just like a fatty ass like tamal with corn, with of course with like maseca, with corn, flour, and like and wrapped in a corn husk, right? And una hoja de maíz, right? And so, but imagine like a fatty ass tamal, like a grenade, okay? Like, it's so good. But they wrap it like it's a, like, you know, like an old school peppermint candy that it has like the circle in the middle and then the two little
size. Yes,
yeah. So imagine wrapping a tamal like that.
Oh my
but
god!
But like a grenade wrapped like a big piece of candy. It's so bomb.
Oh, that sounds so good.
And then you just like cut it up when you eat it, and you eat it with like crema and salsa. And oh,
is she engaging though? Because there's so many señoras, pero ay, cada señora, like it's so funny because they're like. Ay, luego le ponen el chile que tienen. Si no tienen chile, no importa, amiga, póngale de este otro chile y le pone un puñito de esto. Y si no, y they go so fast, they don't really give you a recipe. And then, like, they have.
Damn, everybody's a goddamn critic, not even the señoras que make a YouTube.
Porque hay como miles, güey. Hay como miles señoras haciendo muchas cochinadas. Ay, 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 ay. Pero,
no, I like her because she takes her time. Yeah, she does take her time. And also, you know, you could just pause the video, right? If they're going too fast.
But it's because sometimes I watch it just to be entertained. Like, I want a little bit of personality. I know that like, people should.
It's like the people that listen to podcasts and they're like, that episode was so long. I'm like, you know, you could pause it and listen to it later or just not listen to it. It's a free podcast. What are you doing? What are you doing? Make better choices.
Ya entreguense, qué desorden. Vámonos.
Entreguense a Jehová. You know what, girl? I don't know. I don't think therapy is ever gonna heal. Is gonna heal the wound that the evangelical church lanced through my soul.
I know.
Oh my god! Everything triggers me. Everything. My god. Woo. All right. Okay. Anything else, Bess?
That's it. That's it.
Oh my goodness. Well, as always, you could visit us at latinoswholunch.com. Leave us a review if you like the show. 5 stars.
5 estrellas solamente.
Because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are. And
visibility leads to representation, and representation matters.
Today's episode was produced by Manuel Ortega and Justin Favela with production assistance from Maite Sosa. The music you're listening to now is by the band Balloon. By the way, mm-hmm. A little extra shout out. I know you gave her a shout out a couple episodes again, but Angelica Negron keeps coming out with amazing projects.
Oh my god, she does.
She just worked with Sasha Velour on a project. It's incredible. I am just beyond proud and amazed at our friend. So please go on her Instagram at Little Miss Echo and check out all the work that she's been doing with Balloon and with her own work as a composer. It's incredible. Okay,
amen.
So the music you're listening to is from the band Balloon. I'm Fabi Fab.
And I'm Babelito.
Goodbye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.